You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
The Coaches Network, bringing the game together.
As I say now, I've been coaching near enough 30 years. And the older I've got and the more experience as a coach, the more I realise how little I know.
The Coaches Network, bringing the game together.
You're now listening to The Coaches Network, a podcast aiming to bring people at the heart of coach and player development together. My name is Coach Yas, a UEFA A licensed, FA Advanced Youth Award, and FA Goalkeeper B licensed coach. With over 10 years of experience working in youth football from grassroots right through to Premier League academies, I'm currently operating as an affiliate tutor for the FA, alongside working towards a Master's in Performance Football Coaching. Today I'm going to be joined by my co-host and the Coaches Network Analysis Specialist, Coach Ben. Ben is a UEFA A-licensed coach who holds an FA Youth Award and a Master's in Sports Coaching, with 10 years of experience including working across the male and female youth development pathways, alongside a vast experience on individual, player and team performance analysis. And as part of our Insight series, we'll be joined by a range of individuals working across multiple disciplines within the coaching world in order to explore their journeys and dig deeper into their experiences so that we can leave you with some golden nuggets to help you reach your full potential.
Right, guys, welcome back to the Coaches Network. My name's Coach Yas, and today I've got a very special guest with me. I've got Jason Lee with me. Jason is a performance consultant with various organisations. And currently does some work with the Premier League as well. Good afternoon, Jason. How are you?
Oh, very good. Thanks. Thanks for having me. Good of you.
Likewise. Thanks for being available. Jason, I want to kind of take it straight to the heart of the conversation and get the ball rolling straight away. Would you mind just, you know, for the listeners that maybe aren't sure of who you are or what you do, just go into a bit of detail around what your current role is and how you got into the coaching space in the first place?
Yeah, well, so for many people in football, they kind of often assume that I'm Jason Lee that played for Nottingham Forest in the 80s and 90s, but I'm not that Jason Lee, although I work in a similar space to Jason. So the other Jason, as it were, works for the PFA, particularly in inclusion and diversity coach development. My background is sort of coaching in wider sports, and nowadays I sort of help develop coaches in a lot of sports, but a lot of football coaches. I've been working with the Premier League now for about 6 years as a consultant, trying to help a whole range of coaches.
Brilliant. And just in regards to that, what does that look like on a day-to-day in terms of development of those coaches?
Yeah, so we run a few development programs. At the moment, I'm heavily involved in a program called the BAME Player to Coach Scheme in partnership with EFL and the PFA, trying to help place BAME coaches into professional football, but also help to develop them so that, you know, they can start to, you know, be role models for the next generation of coaches. We have an elite coaching program that I help run for the Premier League, which takes coaches, particularly out of Premier League academies, and tries to just advance their coaching practice, all with a, you know, basic aim, trying to make sure that British football coaching and British English players are just taken to a higher level.
Mm. So, you know, obviously your background isn't, you know, originally from a football coaching background. Would you mind just going into a bit of detail around that and, you know, where, I guess, like I said, you started your journey within the coaching
world? Yeah. Well, I actually was so I played international field hockey through the 80s and 90s, played at a couple of World Cup, a couple of Olympics. But I actually was, like many hockey players back then, I was a failed footballer. So up until the age of 16, I was playing county regional football. I was on the books at Gillingham. But like so many people that didn't make it, I have an excuse. And my excuse was I was a late developer. So when I was 16, I was tiny. I was still under 5 foot, not that I'm that tall now. And sort of there was no opportunity for me sort of as a 16-year-old in football because I just physically couldn't compete. So I wasn't offered many chances at that point. And my mum was a hockey coach and an athletics coach. And because she had a network, she said, why don't you try and play hockey? So I hadn't really played hockey before that age. But because I knew football, because I was used to being kicked around a bit because I was smaller than everybody else, I was pretty quick and committed. I actually did really well in hockey. And within 2 years of picking up hockey, I was playing for England seniors. So I had an incredibly quick progress in the sport. And so then I became a hockey player. And in the 90s, as an international hockey player, like many Olympic sports, there was no funding support. So you had to find some way of playing and training full time while still paying for your bills. And when I graduated from sports science at Loughborough University, the university offered me a job that included coaching. And I think I was the first full-time hockey coach in the country at the age of 22. And so did that alongside playing. So I had 10 years of coaching experience when I retired. And that's when lottery money sort of started. So many Olympic sports, they had sort of full-time coaching jobs. And I became a coach with England and GB hockey. And then a couple of years after that, I became the GB men's head coach and went on to coach through three Olympics. So as I stand now, I've had sort of just short of, I've just turned 50, but I've had 30 years, nearly 30 years of coaching experience.
Fantastic. And, you know, throughout those, obviously, you know, those years, you would have, you know, no doubt come across many other coaches, but also started to think about what coaching should look like for you and, you know, what, I guess, the fundamental principles are for your philosophy in that respect. What would you say those are? And obviously, you know, field hockey is sport very... you know, not too dissimilar to football in you know, in the way it's structured, in the way it's played, obviously, essentially, you know, by the obvious differences, you know, with the ball being at the foot as opposed to the end of a stick. What would you say the main things are that you were able to maybe transfer over from that to obviously now working in the football space, and how does that help you now in your current role in terms of supporting football coaches in particular?
Well, I was always obsessed with how could we make this better, you know, and because I worked in a university setting for 10 years, I had great access to kind of what does academia tell you about sporting excellence. So, you know, I've got a desperate need to find out more about skill acquisition and motor learning, and I've been obsessed with that. Of course, in a team sport, you're fascinated to find out how do you help individuals sort of thrive in a team. So it takes you into the psychosocial world. And again, there was a lot of really eminent psychologists at Loughborough University in my 10 years there that I learned a lot off, you know, and that, so understanding skill acquisition, learning theory and how individuals and teams thrive, you know, that's pretty applicable to between hockey and football. But of course, the sort of the individual and the team stuff, you know, that's applicable across business and education as well. So, you know, how do people do well? I was really lucky at Loughborough, though, because my boss and one of my lecturers was a guy called Rod Thorpe, who and a guy called Dave Bunker. And they're particularly famous because they were the guys that wrote Teaching Games for Understanding. So I had 10 years of influence from those guys, you know, and I think that's kind of what you've seen increasingly sort of come through a lot of team sport coaching about how to make sure people thrive in a decision-rich environment. So, you know, I'm so grateful for the opportunities, experiences that Loughborough gave me, which kind of has meant I found it quite easy to sort of bridge into other sports, but you know, hockey to football was a relatively short step.
And obviously, you know, talking about it being a relatively short step between hockey and football, would you mind just going into a bit around the other sports that you've had, you know, you've had the pleasure of working in?
So I spent a long time working with handball, British handball. I spent a lot of time working with volleyball, both beach and with the sort of the indoor game. Spent some time supporting coaches in rugby and cricket. I was on a performance management group for quite a few years with Paralympic swimming. And just the nature of Olympic sports as well, that you get exposed and sort of mutually support almost every sport. And we used to, our training base for British hockey was Bisham Abbey, which, you know, a lot of football people would know about that place. Because often when England in the old days were playing games at Wembley, they'd spend the week at Bisham. But at Bisham, there's rowing's based out of there. A lot of canoeists are based out of there. A lot of athletes come out of there. So, you know, I've been so lucky through that experience to sort of support and be supported by numerous different sports.
And, you know, just want to take you back to obviously your own coaching journey. And obviously you spent about 10 years or so working in the hockey space before you retired as a player. What were some of the key things that you picked up as a coach then, you know, that you maybe overlooked when you were just a player?
Well, I suppose one of the first, I actually can remember when I had this sort of insight, because for a long time I was playing and coaching, and because I was an international player, I was better than everybody else that I was coaching. And I'm sure many people sort of get this moment. I used to try and help people play, understand what I understood. And I remember trying to work with this sort of, I don't know, 18, 19-year-old, very talented player about how to play on the left wing, which was kind of where I often played. And I was probably only 22, 23 myself at the time. But sort of the realisation that the way I see it doesn't really help unless I can help him to see it for himself. You know, and so I think when coaches who are players that go through that transition understand it's not necessarily about how you see the world, it's how you can help them see it. You know, I can remember where I was on the pitch. It was a Monday night about 7 o'clock. It was just starting to rain because it's Loughborough, because it rains there a lot. You know, and it sort of stopped me in my stride, because I suddenly realised it wasn't about how much I could talk about it. It was how much I could help that guy understand. I still think that's, if people ask me, you know, what do I think is most important for coaches, to understand it's about them, not about you, and kind of all that entails, really.
Definitely. Just, you know, just going through that, then obviously that's a interesting way to look at it, because a lot of coaches, certainly, you know, in the early stages of their career, might think it's about what they know and how to impart their knowledge onto the player without really taking a step back and identifying one, what information might this player actually require based on where they're at in their stage of development? And two, something like what you've touched on there, in that it's all well and good me being able to give them knowledge or try and impart my knowledge, but if they don't see it from the same perspective, or at least you don't, take action towards perspective, then they're probably never going to see it anyway. So what would you say some of the key things are for you in your experiences that have helped you develop that perspective for the athlete?
Yeah, but part of my background when I was a player, I was, which people laugh at now because I'm a bit sort of squeaky clean nowadays, but I was considered to be a bit rebellious. And the coaches used to, I actually got dropped from a few international tournaments because I was too challenging to kind of how we were playing. But I do reflect on actually that at the time that was considered as a weakness in me, but I actually think it was a poorly played strength. And what I mean by that is, like, you know, like I needed help to kind of be able to see it, you know, in other people's perspectives, as other people needed to see it, sort of in my perspective, for a better outcome for all of us. And I do wonder in my time, you know, both particularly as a player, did the coaches sort of just miss some players that could be excellent because it was always discussed from the coach's viewpoint of, you know, training or games or tactical analysis or technique, as opposed to, you know, working with the person in front of you. And the older I get, I don't know if you get this, Yasser, but the more I realise how different people are from each other. You know, and actually the real skill is to help them within a bandwidth of what's acceptable performance, of course, but, you know, help them sort of understand what's the best outcome, best way of doing things for themselves, which I think as soon as you start to think about that, you shut up a bit more. You start wanting to ask questions or help them ask questions of what they're doing so that they can sort of find out their own solutions, you know. And as I've kept on coaching it, the other thing that's amazed me is that just because people see it, you know, a player, an athlete might see it one way this year, things happen to them, and then they suddenly see it a different way. So it's not like you've ever finished that job of trying to help them kind of be curious about how it's working for them. The strange thing about hockey is that hockey keeps changing its rules, which is kind of a... So the way we were able to play one year didn't match the year after that. So we were kind of forced into always being curious about how to make things better. So, I mean, as an example, when I started playing hockey, there was an offside line on the halfway line, same as football. After about three or four years, they moved the offside line to the sort of the three quarters position. Of course, that changed the space and how you could play. And then towards the end of my time, they removed offside completely. And the impact on how you could play was, you know, massive. Not always for the better, in my opinion, but, and, you know, like, so football has been relatively consistent. You know, we've seen more rule changes maybe in the last few years. But I actually think it was a good skill set to, you know, to always sort of figure out how we could do this differently and better, as opposed to just repeat what had happened the year before. You know, and I've seen a lot of that in football now. You know, good coaches now are really interested in not repeating what's happened in past years, even if it worked, but actually trying to recreate something for the future, for the players, for the teams that will be different and better. And I think that's a good route.
Definitely. You know, obviously you touched on there, you know, the rules that have almost forced you, or the constant rule changes have forced you to become more curious about what was happening within the sport. In environments where that might not be the case, you know, what would you say to those coaches who are trying to almost challenge the players to become more curious about how they play in the game and more conscious about those?
As a lot of coaching education is sort of going towards now, the first point of call is, as a coach, what do I think? So actually being curious yourself in the first instance. You know, it's because some sports have not changed for literally decades, and some of the sports I have helped, you see the coach is basically just falling into the habit of repeating what they've done before. And I've seen really great benefits for coaches when they actually have to go and coach, say, a different gender, for example, or a different age group, because like a light bulb, they suddenly realise, as I said earlier, that, my God, people are different. And just being alert to that difference. And actually in football coaching, I've seen some really great coaches come in. I think the diversity thing is really important here, you know, because they come with a different viewpoint, you know, or different experiences. So they're more curious about what it is, as opposed to confident and just about repeating what they've done before. So in helping players to be curious, I think the first point of call is to make sure that the coaches are curious and not too reliant on what they've done before, even if it was successful.
Definitely. And I think, you know, just within that, then, you know, you're talking about coaches becoming more curious. And I think, do you think there's maybe steps that coaches, I guess it's kind of a chicken and egg situation almost. You know, how do you become more curious if you're not already asking the questions, if that makes sense? But for those coaches who are maybe struggling with their curiosity, what would you say is a good place for them to start on that?
I do think everybody can be curious. I think actually one of the things we know about the human species, you know, and our brains want to make life easy. And this is why the problem, you know, we end up having sort of rules of thumb or heuristics, they call it, which some people call biases. And it's basically our brains just trying to sort of make life easier so that we can cope with all the stuff that's flying at us. And so we know that to sort of break that natural habit of our brains is that we have to actively choose to be curious, you know, actively choose to ask questions, you know. So That's why reflective practice has become one of the fundamental parts of developing as a coach. You know, like, how did that, after sessions, how did that go? What did I do? What worked? What didn't work? And making that a sort of a really conscious and active process. And as I say, a lot of coaches come with that sort of instinct anyway, but I think it's a good practice for all of us, and should be conscious, you know, a conscious effort to make sure that we do it. Because I don't know about you, but like, I'm coaching three nights a week at the moment, Saturday, Sunday, and I certainly get to the point where I've been here, done that, and I'm tired. So I just do what I've done before, which normally works okay, but yeah. You have to be really mindful of taking time to still, you know, question myself and what worked, you know, question, look to the player group, you know, see how are they, not assume how they are. You know, we'll ask questions of them, you know, how did that land? What could we do differently? Yeah, so that, I mean, that's my strong advice. But if you can almost, you can't go on a coaching course nowadays without actually really being encouraged to, you know, ask those kind of questions.
Definitely. You know, if you want to take you back to obviously your coaching journey and, you know, some of your observations over your years in various different sports now, what would you say are some of the biggest bugbears for you when it comes to coaching? And have you seen any consistencies or major differences when it comes to those sorts of things across the different sports?
Yeah, I would say that is, I kind of talked about it already. One of my bugbears is when people go, I know the players, I know the athletes. And I think that's, I don't know about you, but I'm 50 now. I don't really know myself. So the premise that somebody else could know me, I sort of laugh the fact that my wife and I, we've been together for 25 years, you know, and she wakes up in the morning and I have no idea what mood she's going to be in. So for a coach of any sport, you know, to kind of assume they know the people they're working with, I think that's a real misdirection. But what we can do is we can keep looking and keep asking the questions, you know, actually, how are the people showing up today? How am I showing up today? Why, you know, what kind of mood am I in, for example? And, you know, I think, as I say, I think the older you get, the more you realize that, you know, people are different and they can be strange and they can change. And if we're really going to sort of help them develop, you know, it's to be aware of that. Because there's a bit of research that I came across about 10 years ago that kind of describes, you know, that about how we might balance the amount of motivational feedback versus developmental feedback. And I think when you really investigate that, you realize that sometimes you can be different with somebody because they've had a good day at work, i.e., they've had lots of motivation, so you can be a bit more challenging. But when you look to people and they've had a bad day, i.e. they've been really challenged, stroke developed or asked to develop all day, you probably need to be a bit motivational. You know, and everybody has seen this when you work with kids. When it's wet and rainy and it's December, you know, like, it's a tough time to push people to improve. You want to just make sure that you motivate them enough so that they want to come back in the spring when the sun's out, you know, and there's an opportunity to push them on into the development, you know, and you only really know that because you're looking and you're interested to how they're turning up and how you're turning up, of course. So that's a little bugbear of mine, that people can proclaim to know people. I think we can try to, and we should always be interested to, but to actually say that we do know them, I actually think that tends to lead us down the wrong path.
Definitely. And you obviously kind of build biggest challenges you face in your journey, because obviously, as you put it, you know, really truly knowing the player is, you know, obviously an incredible thing to be able to do, if at all possible. In terms of that, then obviously that will, you know, in itself will present many challenges for you if you really never get to the heart of who that player is and what they actually need in that respect. What would you say some of the biggest challenges are when it, you know, within your journey then in that respect?
Well, I personally think if you start to embrace the fact that we want to help understand them and show that we want to understand them, but actually we probably can't truthfully, then actually you want to help them understand themselves so that they're, you know, they're more attuned to actually how they are. And it immediately starts sort of, I think, it redirects your coaching to how can I help them help themselves, as opposed to how can I, you know, how can I help them? You know, subtle difference. How can I help them help themselves? So I think the skill set often of coaching becomes less about what do I know, and how much information can I know, although that is really important. And it flips to actually how can I help them learn? How can I help them understand? And then that's for many coaches, like you kind of, your reward is because you feel like you can show people you know stuff. And actually, to help other people, sometimes your greatest strength you have to put in your back pocket and keep quiet, because actually you want them to be able to demonstrate their knowledge. And a very, very wise old coach said to me, sort of on this subject, he said, Jason, if you do a really good job, they won't be thanking you for it, as in the players won't be thanking, because they'll think they've done it themselves. And he says, so then what you got to do is make sure that you've got your own reward system. It feels nice when the players, athletes say thanks, but I don't necessarily think that has to be the measure of whether you've done a good job. It's actually, do they feel like they've been the best of themselves, and did you facilitate that? And I think that's an interesting interesting challenge for coaches, And in coaching and mentoring, sort of in the general world, not in sports world, one of the mantras is that as soon as you enter as a coach or a mentor, you should actually be trying to develop the person or help them develop so that they don't need you anymore. The aim is that you don't need to be present, so they don't need you. So that is obviously a challenge, particularly in sort of, football. How do you prove if you're good? Because you could be a great coach, but they don't win the game. And so where's your source of reward? I just think that's an interesting challenge, for coaches.
Definitely. And I think, one thing I've always said is, the ultimate thing is to, as a coach, is to try and make yourself redundant in many ways and get to a point where almost the players feel.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So around.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
You become sort of a trusted friend as opposed to a kind of a parent or an authority, for sure. And for some people, their ego sort of becomes a challenge to that, like for all of us. It's nice to be thanked, and it's hard to identify when actually you've done a good job, but they don't choose to thank you.
Definitely. So just kind of coming back to your own journey then, I was wondering where, throughout the years of your coaching, whether you've had any major influences, possibly in the form of a mentor, or if you've had any particular experiences where you felt that, you've really taken away something major for your development.
Yeah, well, as I say, I was really influenced. I didn't recognise it at the time, but I was really influenced by Rod Thorpe, the author of Teaching Games for Understanding. Rod was a coach in many sports. And as I've got older, sort of reflected back, it's like, oh yeah, that's what Rod told me about. But in recent years, to be honest, I've been working in football. There are so many great people in football. I feel like I've been influenced positively by so many people. Even this morning with a coach from cricket, I was talking about how Ian Mitchell, who works for the FA, is the head of psychology, I think, now. He's a pro-licensed coach, used to work in Swansea Academy. You know, how he kind of made me realise that sort of certain psychological characteristics that you want to develop in players, actually you can see it in how they play football. It's not a separate thing. We can describe personal resilience as in how often, how tight do they mark? Do they close down the wingers when they're about to cross? I found that really powerful to understand the behaviours that psychological characteristics tend to sort of reveal. As I say, there's a huge list of people like that I've met, particularly in the last sort of 7-8 years working in football, because there are so many great people working in the game in this country.
Talking to that ends, you're now working in football, but, doing a lot of work within football. I wanted to kind of maybe delve in a bit around your work with the Premier League and, obviously some of the stuff that you do there. You talked there about the BAME, player-to-coach scheme. Would you mind just shedding a bit more information around some of the other initiatives and things that you've worked on within your time?
Yeah, so the Premier League have tried to sort of influence sort of football people's development in ways that traditionally wasn't really the developed areas. So some people would say that the Premier League's focusing on sort of on more holistic things, but I think the Premier League's just trying to add to the things that traditionally the FA, for example, have developed. So we've niched a lot into sort of personal leadership, how you work with other people, try to develop, do some work to improve diversity, inclusion in the system, try to create a better connection between football coaches and multidisciplinary teams, how does a football coach work really effectively with sports scientists, strength and conditioning coaches, psychology, medical department, for example, stuff like that. So we've tried to add to the knowledge and skill set of coaches in the professional game, because there's using the wider sort of sources of support in football is a great opportunity. To be honest, it's one of the ways that Team GB got to the top of the medal rankings, leveraging the support services that other countries weren't doing quite so well. Unfortunately, we're seeing around the world that the rest of the world sort of realised they're caught up, Team Ineos or Team Sky, as it was, that all the things that they were sort of groundbreaking, the other countries have caught up in cycling. But, we still know that there is opportunity in football to sort of create better links between those services and coaching and then the development of players, for sure. And I say a lot of the Premier League programmes trying to sort of help with that, for sure, and partner with the FA and the PFA to sort of support the development of the more traditional areas of, tactical development, technique development, session design, coaching behaviours.
I just want to kind of obviously to, touch on your involvement in the BAME initiatives now, and what are your thoughts on what the landscape of, the number of ethnic coaches there are in the current, England in particular. What are your thoughts on that? Do you feel that we're progressing in any ways?
It's an emotive area, isn't it? Yes, it's certainly, and it's a complicated area too. And one of the things, because I've got a science background, I like to delve into the stats as well. And I think if you actually look into the stats, the representation of different groups as players, as coaches, and as a sort of officials, leadership in clubs, what you do see is there's a there's a disparity, but actually you see a trend that they're all starting to, in terms of diversity, they're all starting to improve the diversity. So I think if we just left things alone, things would naturally improve. If improving is that the the football is more, football's more inclusive and diverse. But, you know, we want to do it. We want to get there quicker. You know, we want to accelerate that natural rate of change because, to be frank, it's too slow probably. And also we know there's, it's sort of dirty word to say, but there is some institutional racism that's probably always going to be a barrier unless we start to really do some stuff to break down those barriers. And one of the things we do know to a large degree for an ethnic minority football coach, if he or she doesn't see somebody like themselves in the professional game, I'm not sure it's achievable. And we want to start putting, you know, different ethnic minority coaches, male and female, into the professional game so that they can be role models to show that that pathway is available. And also to work with the system so that the system starts to, you know, reduce some of the barriers to entry to these groups. And one of the main ones, probably more in football in this country than almost any industry, is that typically clubs recruit people that they know and trust, which is fine, but it does tend to mean that they're typically people that look like them. And we have a great opportunity to improve the performance and, you know, the sort of the community of football if we improve the diversity. But, you know, there's lots of little things that are holding it back at the moment. But like my observation is there's lots of signs that it's improving, but there's a long way to go yet.
Definitely. You obviously touched on there about the recruitment of most of these roles, and tends to be people that they know, and it ends up being people that they end up then looking like too. What would you say are some of the things that could be done at this stage? Obviously, now they've probably got their initiatives, and the EFL coming up with some of their initiatives along with the FA. What would you say are some of the things that that could be done to maybe support these changes sooner rather than later? Because at the end of the day, there's you can't really control if someone has been brought in on, you know, as part of an initiative, and at the end of an initiative that they, you know, is disposed of in some ways. Also with the, you know, the code that the EFL brought in regarding essentially the Rooney rule and how that's been played out, there's many clubs that probably have opted in, but actually the way it's been run is also those clubs are still maybe just bringing certain BME coaches as part of that interview process just to kind of tick a box. You know, what kind of things do you think could be done to maybe manage that and, I guess, control that process a bit more closely?
Well, there are lots of little opportunities to nudge things to get better. I think the expectation should be that's a big thing to move, and but that we should be desperately trying to move things. I think the first point of call, which sometimes doesn't get reacted to particularly well, but becoming a full-time football coach in the professional game is really tough. And so every single cat person who has an aspiration to become a full-time football coach in the professional game has to realise how tough that is. And that's a big onus on you to really be a great, great candidate. There was a Premier League Category 1 Academy that recently advertised for a job in the academy. And the open recruitment process. It's a great club. They got 350 applicants, and I knew lead phase coaches in Category 1 Premier League academies with their A licence and 10 years experience weren't getting interviews. Because there was stronger candidates above them. I find that if I was a coach, I'd find that that's a big bar that you're going to have to get close to. So then, you know, okay. One of the problems is it's tough to get the qualifications at the moment. Getting onto your A licence or B licence is tough, tough, tough. And I think the FA are doing a good job to try and open up, provide easier access to some of those qualifications for BAME coaches. Because, you know, nowadays with the regulations, if you haven't got these qualifications, the chances of getting a job is really, really slim. And I think still talking about the candidates is like, okay, well, you're going to have to get yourself some experience, get yourself in volunteering with the clubs, get in through part-time, through the development centres, so that the clubs start to know you, judge your quality and trust you. But then, you know, there's equal responsibility on the system, on the clubs. You know, I think the clubs are increasingly starting to advertise jobs. If you follow any job sites, the last 4 years, it's just starting to be packed with jobs in football. But 5-6 years ago, you wouldn't see these jobs advertised. And the recruitment practices were, you know, often done quick and pointed people that they know. So we want to try and influence that for sure. We do know just making measurements on actually what's the breakdown of your staff, you know, starts to reveal great things that, you know, need to change. Yes, so many things. I mean, the advice I give to a lot of coaches I'm supporting, BAME coaches at the moment, is when they ask, it's like, you know, you start to get yourself known in the network. And as I say, the Premier League, EFL, the PFA, the FA, and the LMA, all these agents are starting to try and help everybody create a network so that they get, you know, they can start to see the opportunities, as well as establishing, you know, what kind of standard do you have to get to be competitive for these jobs. So I see a lot of the stakeholders really working hard to try and improve this space. But as I said, there's a lot of work to do.
You know, just on that, you see, you know, you talk there about, you know, essentially building that network and getting yourself in a position where essentially you can tick all the boxes necessary to get into that role. But, you know, if I'm going to take you back a few minutes, you touched on how difficult it can be to get on some of these qualifications. And obviously in recent years, we've seen organisations like the FA put initiatives in place for maybe, you know, the BAME community and female community coaches as well, in terms of maybe allocating X number of places for those sorts of candidates, on whether that be the B license or the A license. But in some cases, you know, that's also not been met very well with coaches who maybe don't fall into those communities. What would your message be to those coaches there, and you know, that might be experiencing some frustration because of some of these initiatives that are in place?
Do you mean sort of other groups that don't get the opportunity, or the
yeah exactly, you know, a lot of it's recently with some of the FA initiatives, and even some people referring to even the Premier League initiatives as, you know, an element of being there, positive racism in some ways.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if you look into the research in this area across the world, you know, like any diversity inclusion intervention, there's two sides to the argument. One is, as soon as you start to identify and give a name to a discriminated group, you actually increase the discrimination by identifying them. And we've certainly seen that some of these programs around the world has had unforeseen and unfortunate consequences to the group that the people are trying to help. You know, and we're all aware that there's an increasing number of people that said, please do not call me BME or BAME. I want to be, I'm me, I'm unique. You know, we do know that just identifying groups is a problem, and because other people then, you know, turn against them. And unfortunately, whether we like it or not, one of our basic human drivers is to kind of feel safe with people around us and decide who's against us. So we're fighting against basic human nature here. So, you know, it's most of the academic research advice is that, you know, you need to do some positive action, but be very, very cautious about the unforeseen negative consequences of that action. Is exactly what you alluded to. Yes. And, you know, I think what we've seen is the solution is that you start to make sure that people get to know each other first through the network, so that they see each other as, you know, Jason and Yasser, rather than BAME coach, white, bald coach, you know. And so when we know this, when people start to get to know each other, they start to create rapport, trust, and then they judge each other on different characteristics, whether you're a good coach or less good coach, rather than your ethnicity. So, if you get that, what I'm sort of describing about that conflict between trying to make a change, but actually that change itself comes with some negative consequences. It's why it's not been solved yet. It's one of the reasons why it's not been solved yet.
You know, to build on that, then, you know, obviously you don't want to, I guess, class everyone as one. But, you know, if you had to go back, you know, give us almost a golden nugget for some of our listeners to kind of take on board and apply for themselves within their own journeys. you know, you don't like to think of it as being two separate things, but if you was a you know, just a coach generally, what advice would you give that coach? And, you know, would there be any adaptations or development beyond that advice if the coach was coming from an underrepresented group and, you know, looking to more, if that makes sense?
Yeah, well, to be honest, it's so individual. I worked with some disadvantaged kids in the East End of London, around the London Olympics, because I wanted to make sure if we didn't win a medal, which we didn't, we came fourth, that we actually could be proud of what we did in that Olympic cycle, you know, a home Olympics. And we worked with about 60 kids from a disadvantaged background that with a charity that was trying to support these kids. And we got them to play hockey. You know, there was no hockey in Newham, Tower Hamlets and Hackney at the time. And we were playing on tarmac and stuff, you know, and they sort of saw hockey as a, you know, which it is, unfortunately, at the moment, sort of posh upper sport, upper class sport. But, it, you know, fundamentally, a lot of those kids are coaches in sports, a range of sports now. Quite a few have gone to university, quite a few, bizarrely, a lot of them are still playing hockey. But the thing was that somebody was giving them an opportunity. And I think that's one of the things that we want the system to start to provide is more opportunity in these sort of the areas where people aren't getting it. But still, the kids that did progress, you know, went on to university out of these kids we're working with, they had a lot of fire in their belly themselves. You know, they weren't waiting for us to provide something for us. They fought for it and went and did something themselves, you know. And one of my proudest moments with some of these kids is when they went off and did... like they became tennis coaches because they saw an opportunity because there was the Lee Valley Tennis and Hockey Center that got built just over the A12. If people know that, a few of them realized that if they got themselves qualified as tennis coaches, there was all these tennis courts that they could, you know, there was an opportunity to start getting some work. And, you know, so it was partly people providing the opportunity. We want to do that for the system for sure. But, you know, like, start finding out what, you know, being driven yourself, creating your networks, getting as qualified as experienced as you can. And, you know, it's the route through it, you know, so it's they're yours as an individual and the system's responsibility, but in equal measure.
I just want to take you back to your story. Yeah, no, definitely. And I think, you know, I just want to take you back to your own journey a little bit now, you know, getting into coaching still, a relatively young age and obviously still playing at the time, you know, knowing what you do know now about the coaching world and some of the, you know, across not just the hockey domain, but across sports in general, what would be one message that you'd want to give yourself at the start of that journey? That
yeah. So,
back on the information that you know,
now, I would tell myself not to get like too cocky about it. So I'm not a cocky person, but I did, after about 5-6 years of coaching full time, I thought I was getting pretty close to knowing what this job was all about and how to do it. As I say, now I've been coaching near enough 30 years. And the older I've got and the more experience as a coach, the more I realise how little I know. And, you know, part of the cost of that is I'm coaching 3 nights a week now and Saturdays, Sundays, and I actually have a little bit more angst coaching than I used to because I can see all the potential problems, you know, and I've tried things before that have worked and then suddenly they didn't work. You know, but I would be telling myself, you know, keep, you know, you've got to keep learning here, Jason. What you think you know today might not work tomorrow. And as a young coach, I couldn't even imagine that being the situation. You know, it's a long, tumultuous journey to, you know, to coach, to keep helping, and particularly in this country because the paid opportunities are rare, you know, and people lose their jobs so often in sports coaching and professional environment. You know, you have to be resilient to keep going, and I would say that to myself really. I generally got quite lucky. I was in the right place at the right time when opportunities came up, but that wasn't of my own design. So yeah, they're the kind of things I would be saying to myself.
Definitely. You know, just as we start to wind down now, I know, just, you know, currently working as a performance consultant, you know, across different organisations, what would you say is next for you in your journey?
Well, I've always, you know, I think a lot of people that have come from sort of working in elite sport have got this. Like I just, you know, it took me a long time to realize this, but I'm obsessed with doing a good job. So I've become, you know, like at the moment I'm working in sort of inclusion and diversity, and I'm obsessed with really trying to help that. And it's difficult. I'm coaching a lot now. I'm obsessed with trying to help the teams and the players that we're working with. I work in sort of business environments. I'm obsessed with, and I work in policing a bit at the moment as well. And I'm obsessed with helping the people. So I suppose it's just, you know, keep going, doing what I'm doing, keep trying to help him, keep trying to do it better, really. I haven't got a sort of a North Star in terms of I want to be a Premier League manager or anything like that. Just want to keep on doing, you know, better and better job and keep learning, keep trying to help.
Definitely. You know, just obviously you talk there about having 30 years of coaching experience already as well. You know, as you start to, you know, move towards, I guess, the back end of your career, and hopefully you have another 30 years still in you. Not sure how happy your missus will be about that, but 30 years, hopefully. What would you say, you know, when it comes to the end of that career, what would you want your legacy to be for the people that you've worked with?
Well, that's a great question, really. And because I do think about stuff like that. Stephen Covey, who wrote the Habits of Highly Effective People, if you've ever come across that, does talk about act with the end in mind, you know, and there's a lot of stories about how people suddenly get a real epiphany just as they're about to die, you know, a bit late there, son. So I do kind of contemplate what I'd like people to sort of say about me as a, you know, I waddle off to somewhere else. And I quite simply, though, I just want to make sure I'd like people to think that they thought I was genuine and genuinely try to help, you know, and doing it to help other people and not for myself, you know. And you know, and that's one of the challenges of work of coaching in a team environment, because unfortunately we can only put 11 on the pitch, not 12, you know, so there's always those challenges of how do I help people when I can't put them in the team. You know, so it's going to be an ongoing challenge. Probably why I feel so, you know, I have so much angst sometimes now coaching, because I've seen, you know, how sort of impactful those kind of decisions can have on players. So yeah, as I look back, people go, my nickname's Lee Boy. I've had that for a long time. And I go, Lee Boy genuinely tried to help us, you know, and he's a good man.
And just to kind of wrap up now, Jason, I want to thank you again for your time. And I just wanted to, if the listeners did have any questions they wanted to kind of follow up with, both regarding the information that you've shared with us in this conversation, and even maybe questions beyond. Is there any way that...
I'm not that active on social media, but I do have a Twitter link, Jace8Lee, Jase8Lee. You can DM through that. That's no problem.
Well, there you have it, guys. Another edition of the Coaches Network Insight Series, where we sit down with experienced individuals across the multiple disciplines within the coaching world, hoping to explore their journeys and key insights in order to package away some golden nuggets that you can apply to help you reach your full potential. I've no doubt that you've enjoyed today's episode as much as we have, but I just want to say thanks again for tuning in. The support is much appreciated. Please do get in touch with us and today's guests. Let us know where you're listening from to share your thoughts, views and key takeaways from today's show, along with any suggestions you may have for guests or future topics on the show that you'd like to hear discussed. Ultimately, guys, the show is about yourselves. The content is for you, and we just want to continue to create that great content. On that note, get in touch with us on Instagram at The Coaches Network and on Twitter at The Coaches Net. And if you want to touch base with Coach Ben, he's available on Instagram and Twitter at FocusBXN. Lastly, guys, keep an eye out on our socials for the latest updates and announcements for upcoming guests and discussion topics with the panel. And until next time, guys, take care.
The Coaches Network, bringing the game together.
Swimsuit? Check. Sunscreen? Check. Phone charger? Check. Don't forget to pack the 5-Hour Energy. It fits great in a pocket or carry-on, and the alert feeling will help you arrive ready for anything. Now get 20% off when you use code 5HETRAVEL at 5HourEnergy.com. Expires April 30th. One-time use only. Not valid with other discounts. Remember, visit 5HourEnergy.com and use code 5HETRAVEL to save 20%.
catch those springtime vibes all over Arizona. Break out of the winter blues by hitting the water at one of our lake and river parks. Take a hike among the wildflowers. Just make sure to stay on the trails and leave the flowers for the bees. Discover Arizona's best kept secret and visit azstateparks.com/amazing to start your springtime adventure.